from the crypt.
Hello, boys and ghouls. Welcome to episode 104 of Dads in the Crypt. This week, we lost not just a member of the Tales in the Crypt family, but an icon of cinema. Of course, I'm talking about William Friedkin. Instead of our usual episode, today we will be gathering a group of podcasters and filmmakers to pay tribute to Hurricane Billy. We won't be going too deep into his Tales from the Crypt episode on A Dead Man's Chest. Alan Gill will be discussing that episode in depth on their How Not to Make a Movie podcast. But tonight, again, we're talking all about William's entire filmography. We're going to be talking a lot about The Exorcist because most of us are horror fans. For me, it's easily in one of my top five all-time movies. And any given day, it could be my number one. It touches me on a technical level, on a spiritual level, on a pure scary level. I've seen it in the theaters, and it's probably one of the most tense movies, even though I've seen it dozens of times. It's just, on a technical level, just grabs you. And what's even crazier is that that was his movie after making The French Connection, for which he won Best Director for. Usually when people win Oscars, their follow-up isn't as good as that. They're trying to reach for the stars again, and they don't usually reach it. But this time, he made a definitive movie for entire genre. I can't think of any possession movie that has come close to The Exorcist before or since then. That just goes to show, again, another level of how good he was on this game. And he's a type of director who really took big swings. If you've ever seen the movie The Sorcerer, which, again, has nothing to do with sorcery, has no sorcerers in it, but is about a group of convicts who are driving trucks full of nitroglycerin that could easily explode, has become unstable through the jungle over rivers and storms. Again, it's a movie that makes you just grab the seat of your chair. In other big swings, Cruising is, you know, very subversive, interesting film. You got Al Pacino playing a cop who goes undercover in the gay scene in New York City in the early 80s to find a serial killer. He filmed in many real clubs. And again, it's another slice of life, very documentary. And that's what I think I like a lot about his film style. He came from a documentary background, and he kind of kept that, but in other genres. He kept that realness, that grittiness. But again, we'll be talking about a lot of this tonight. So first off, I'm going to kick it over to Freddie. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, yeah, I'm Freddie Morris. I'm the producer and one of the hosts of Night of the Living podcast, and a musician as well, composer. William Friedkin, when you reached out to me, Jason, about doing this, it's funny because I realized there were all these holes in my knowledge, because our show is a show, again, like yours, about horror films and horror stories. And to my experience with William Friedkin was primarily The Exorcist and The French Connection and Jade much later. And I was a fan of Jade, which I still am. I like the movie quite a bit, but it's so funny that this just gave me a great excuse to spend, I think it was 4+ hours, maybe 5 hours today, just reading and watching stuff and just catching up, especially on early. Like, I didn't realize I had seen The Thin Blue Line. I didn't know was the one who had directed that old documentary about the police. So it's really, really interesting. I want to thank you for inviting me on.
In your rewatching, what did you uncover? Did you find a new favorite? What revelation did you come? Because I also did a lot of rewatching this and watching a lot of William Friedkin movies in a row. It's almost taxing because it just makes movies are so tense.
They're tense, and also, like, especially The Birthday Party, which I had never seen before. I watched it this morning, and it's a lot of actors I really like. Robert Shaw, who was Quentin Jaws, but it's based on this Harold Pinter play, and I was like, God, this is something I should have, if I wanted to enjoy this, I'd have to gear up to enjoy it because it is very, one, it's set in England with a Chicago filmmaker directing English actors. And it feels like there's moments that are kind of lost a little bit for me. I think it just requires so much more attention and participation from the audience than what we can give on a moment's notice anymore. The conditioning in my brain is so different. This was made in 68, I think. And to sit down with this movie and just inhabit this very kind of uncomfortable boarding house for 2+ hours with characters who are literally just trying to drive each other crazy was a lot. You know, I came out and I was like, I don't know if that movie was for me as much as I like other William Friedkin films. And it was too much. But luckily, I followed it up with the night they raided Menzies, I think is the name.
Minsky's.
Minsky's, thank you. The New York, it's the one set in the 1925 New York burlesque shows and vaudeville shows. And it's a completely different tone. And it's old Hollywood, which is crazy because, you know, he's always credited as being part of that 70s movement that changed Hollywood. Then he makes his second feature is very much like an old Hollywood, but also through the lens of like, you know, vaudeville and that pre-Hollywood attitude that anything goes. And they're kind of experimenting with what is not pornography. Maybe it might not be pornography. What's entertainment? Yet it has the Cowardly Lion in it, like actors from all walks. And it's the only movie I know that has someone who appeared in hardcore pornography and the Cowardly Lion together. And I think that only happens with William Friedkin in charge, if that makes sense. So that's a learning thing for me, because I loved his attitude, like the whole story about him meeting Hitchcock and saying, you know, I'm not going to wear a fucking tie. You can't make me wear a tie, you know, to the most powerful director at the time. And you're like a young up and comer. And I just kind of respected that attitude of, you know, I'm a good filmmaker. I don't need how to dress, you know, to dress how you tell me to dress. I chose this line of work because I don't want to live through that kind of corporate environment. So I like him as a rock star kind of icon more so, I think, even than a filmmaker. It's more about the attitude behind his filmmaking. And there are a handful of, like, I think, great movies and like real gems throughout his filmography, but there are also some weird clunkers in there that I don't connect with.
Yeah, I think Sorcerer. Has anyone else here seen Sorcerer?
Okay, long time ago.
Yeah, I watched it again this week, and it's a flawed but very good movie in many ways. I think the name alone is kind of indicative, where it has such a weird name, and like you have to really twist it to make sense.
When you're a kid, that's super disappointing.
Yeah. But it's an awesome movie. But it's an awesome movie in way. Yeah, but in other ways that some parts just don't make any sense. And that's William Friedkin. For better or for worse, he has a vision. And if you're not on board, he's just going to drop you and find someone else to follow up on his vision. And luckily, he was right many more times than he was wrong.
True.
All right. Well, thank you, Freddie. Let's move on to Levi.
Hey.
Hey, Levi.
I want to say first, thanks for having me on.
Where are you from?
Why don't
you introduce your show?
Oh, cool. Yeah. I co-host a podcast called Well Adjusted Horror. Both us hosts love the genre for two different reasons. And we try to meet in the middle on some of our favorites. And we talk about socio-political meanings to certain horror films and how they relate to what's going on around us. So, Well-Adjusted Horror. It's fun. And we actually covered this film a couple of weeks ago. Well, actually, it was more about a year ago. And we covered what Stephen King had to say about William Friedkin and The Exorcist. And it happens to be one of our favorites. It's kind of hard not to be. And we encourage people who haven't watched The Exorcist, even though it might be kind of standoffish for them, to watch it, because we do think it is important. And so when you asked You put out a thing, who wants to join? I was like, ooh, me, pick me. Yes. Yes, please. So.
All right. David, why don't you introduce yourself and let's talk some freaking.
Sure. So my name's David. I am a filmmaker and editor, and I've been working mainly in the documentary world. And I guess the real reason I'm here is that I edited a documentary back a few years ago called Leap of Faith, William Friedkin on The Exorcist, which is a sit-down interview with Friedkin. He's the only cast member of this documentary. And it's a personal journey of his creative process that went into The Exorcist. It's, we sort of tried to move away from the sort of entertaining backstage anecdotes and really dig into the creative decisions he made along the way to create, you know, what I guess a lot of us think are, is a masterpiece, one of the greatest movies, maybe horror movies of all time. And I got to sort of, you know, live in the footage of this interview for, you know, a long time, and kind of it felt a little like trying to live in the brain of Friedkin and sort of see how he ticks and operates. And I got to meet him one time when I first came on the project. We had to go over there and do an audio pickup day for a couple hours. And so got to go over to his house and meet him and, you know, have a mini experience. I mean, he couldn't have been nicer, but I got a little taste. Not, I didn't have any, I don't have any great, you know, Hurricane Billy stories. I did have to set up like a microphone stand for the audio pickups, and he didn't like how I set it up. So he just grabbed it and moved it closer. And I didn't really know what I was doing. I'm not a sound guy. I was just sort of brought on. So he did know better. I'll give him that. But yeah, he was, it just couldn't have been more gracious with us throughout the whole process. And he loved the movie. And I'm just really happy that we got to bottle, you know, a version of that experience while Friedkin still had a lot of like that fire in it. And I think, you know, that's there in that movie. I rewatched it last night. It's a weird thing to, I hadn't watched it in a while, and the movie's colored so differently with his passing. There's a lot of stuff about death in the movie, but also about how he approached his life and how you can approach your life as an artist, and how to utilize your influences and kind of hone your point of view. Anyway, I'm making an advertisement for the documentary. No, that's
I mean,
that's my main Friedkin experience.
Yeah, definitely. And when I, especially when I saw that, anytime I see it, I love Friedkin interviews. I'm a big sucker for like DVD extras and stuff. So I always liked watching his behind the scenes stuff. Cause again, he just tells you he's not sugarcoating anything.
Oh, what a force. He's a character, and that can be bigger than the movies and distract from them for some directors. Like Yudowski or Herzog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He reminds me a lot of Herzog. He also really reminds me of my grandfather. He just has that kind of really gruff, like what's this bullshit attitude. I think of that generation that just like reminds me, like, you know, if I tell my grandfather about Nintendo, he's like, what's a fucking Nintendo? I don't care. So there's something very grandfatherly, at least about later phase Friedkin in interviews. And I obviously watched Leap of Faith right when they came out, not just because I know you and you're the editor, but it's, you know, something that's right up my alley. And I watched it again today. It's just so poignant. And so I was wondering if you could tell me, did he want to make this movie? Did someone approach him? And why did he say yes at this point to go into that? Do you have any background on that?
I'm not sure about, you know, his relationship and sort of how reluctant he was and stuff. I know that the director, Alexander Philippe, I've worked with a couple times since, and we're working on more projects together. He met Billy at a famous festival called the Stitches Festival, sort of a genre festival, and Friedkin beckoned him over to his table and told and was a fan of Alexander's. Alexander had made a movie about the shower scene in Psycho called 78/52, and Friedkin loved it. And in a way, Friedkin courted Alexander and was like, you know, read my autobiography and let's talk. And that got the ball rolling on this. So
yeah,
that's sort of the origin story.
No, that's good. Yeah, it's so interesting to me that of all of his movies, he wanted to make one very specifically about The Exorcist, that it's such a personal movie for him.
Because I think that might have come from Alexander. Let's focus. Well, you know, we can tell some version of your life and your point of view, but focusing through the prism of that one movie, because otherwise it's you're trying to cover a lot of ground.
Well, yeah, but I appreciate that he was willing to go into, because that movie was so massive for so many years that he wasn't like shying away from it like some other creators sometimes do from their seminal work.
I think they get burned out on talking about things like that.
Yes.
But to catch somebody who still has that sparkle in their eye is pretty amazing at that age, too.
For sure. Like, and we were able to find some new things where, you know, he was talking about, I didn't really understand the ending, but I shot it the way that Blatty explained it to me. And, you know, he goes through where he thinks the logic conflicts in it. And, you know, I hadn't heard that before.
Yeah,
David, I want to second Jason's praise for your documentary. I also really loved Leap of Faith. And I didn't know you worked on it until just now. So, no, but still, you did a great job with the edit. And I think it's cool to kind of hear you talk about setting the mic, because I know Friedkin was a documentarian in the beginning. So like he had to have some sympathy for you there.
Well, also, we didn't have a camera with us, so he could just have it right in his face.
Okay.
And set it little too far back, I guess. And with the sound, actually, with the air conditioning came on in his house, and I, you know, made a little signal to the director, and Friedkin was like, "Why? What's the deal?" And you know, it's like, "Oh, you know, the air conditioning. Thinking maybe we turn it off." And he was like, "If that's a problem for you, then you're fucked. You know, right. Like, we're rolling."
Also, and, you know, he leaves a lot of noise in his movies.
Yeah,
yeah, for sure.
Which it doesn't bother me. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, as a documentarian, he's like, right, no, it's real. Leave it in.
Right. And you know, it was fine.
I do want to do a quick opening because you did talk about the scene, the part in your movie where he's trying to talk about the ending, which I absolutely love how that ending plays out in The Exorcist. And I think maybe we could all kind of give opinions. But mine is, I think what I really love about that, it's not like he didn't have a weapon to like drive out the demon. I mean, they have the holy water, but that may or may not have worked depending on how you look at it. But the fact that Damien accepted his faith and opened himself up and was able, and the demon saw him as a more suitable or more powerful host or target, but he was still able to have a moment of clarity to sacrifice himself through the window, which again is a literal leap of faith to his death.
Faith. Yeah, to believe usually, that logic also, yes.
Because usually when people talk about leap of faith, they usually land and they're rewarded for their leap of faith. And here, no. I mean, he's you can look at a spiritual reward, like redemption or acceptance, but no, he didn't like magically land on a pillow that was, you know, placed there. Right. No, he goes through the window, down flights of stairs, and is just like pulverized and withering at the bottom of the steps.
Has anyone ever cut that scene together with the Jackass music?
Oh my God.
All right, David, when I put this out, I want you to get me an edit for a TikTok for that. Right. But I want to open it up.
Wrapped himself in so many, you know, different kind of puzzles of logic around that, where like, you know, he thinks that it's like an extra sacrifice where Karis is going to hell because he committed suicide in the Catholic faith. And it's like, you know, an eternal sacrifice or something. But yeah, it was refreshing to hear like, you know, somebody being honest about a creative choice that you know, was undoubtedly successful, but he still questions it.
Which, again, is another leap of faith. But I want to open that up to like Levi or Matt, who joined us. If you guys have other interpretations of the ending that you want to share.
It's not like another interpretation. It's just kind of like the focus of it is like we covered the third Exorcist, which I don't think Friedkin was that involved with. But in the third Exorcist, there's like divine intervention to save the day, basically. And in the first Exorcist, there's not, you know. And so, like, there's a question there of how you interpret it as, was that God intervening, or, you know, would Friedkin, you know, would have thought that that was what he was putting in there? I don't know, you know. So it's interesting that in the third one they actually do have like a divine intervention moment, but in the first one they don't, you know. It's way more interesting to me, you know, of course. But I just thought that was a point about the end that had always stuck with me throughout the years. So.
Yeah. Matt, do you have anything you want to add?
I wanted to say I 100% agree with everyone's takes about it. And especially what Levi just said as well. I don't really know how, like, philosophically how I would take the ending, but I thought it was a good way to end it. I thought it was a very interesting way to handle the situation for Father Karras. And I think it was, in a way, yeah, like, I don't know if I'm going by the perspective of the director but I just say
yours.
I don't know. Let's see. How should I say this? If I were to put it into perspective, I believe it was a good way to make like a possible sacrifice in the end. Whether or not the outcome was reached, I don't know. I don't know if it was I believe the ending was perfect the way it was. I don't think that there was any underlying message there other than it was just a good way to close it out.
Yeah, I definitely see that. Has anyone else read the book of The Exorcist?
Yeah. And that's what I'm trying to remember, because the conversation you guys were just having about the ending. Yeah, was the book different in the end?
Well, the book wasn't different, but it doesn't specify what happened. It's from the mother's perspective in the hallway. She kind of hears what happens.
Okay. But, right. Friedkin says that Blatty was copping out by doing that.
I do highly recommend the book. It's one of the scariest books I've ever read. Like, I couldn't read it at night.
Have you read Legion?
I have not read Legion. But
it's fantastic.
Okay. Yeah. But the book for The Exorcist is very, very good. It's very much like the movie, but there's definitely a lot more detail to some of the things that happen and some of the characters.
Well, the white noise bit, that's one thing I wish Friedkin had done with The Exorcist, was he only has Karras reference. We sent the tapes to a woman, Kentner, or whatever her name was. I'm thinking of Jaws probably, but I sent the tapes away and they came back and they're, languages she couldn't possibly know, you know, all these things. But in the book, if you remember, there's that whole subplot with her. Well, I can't remember if it was a woman in the book or not, but it was this character who worked in a recording studio and they would record dead air. It was the first time I've ever read anything that sounded like what they call, everyone knows what an EVP is now from ghost hunting shows. But the first time I ever heard that in culture was reading The Exorcist, the book. Was this idea that there's spiritual frequencies floating in the air that you can't hear until you've recorded the actual air itself and then played it back. And that was the only thing that I found that for me made the movie less exciting than the book was exciting. Cause it felt, it had that, I understand why he took it out, because it was more about a crisis of faith in Father Karras. The theme became more potent because he removed that. But I wish I would love to have seen a version with that in there, because it gave me the heebie-jeebies.
Yeah. I want to read. There's a bit in the movie that just really hit me from the Leap of Faith documentary, and I don't know, maybe I'll edit in his voice or something like that. But he's at one point, he says, "All I know is that we have nothing to say about our birth and the time and place and means in which we die. Life is ambiguous, which is why my films are." I mean that wraps up his whole thesis right there, because again, there's still ambiguity of how or why Father Karras did what he did. Was the girl really possessed, like, or was it like some group hysteria? In the French Connection, who really is the good guys? Were the cop good guys? They shot one of their own officers in the end, and the bad guy got away. You know, we're used to rooting for the cops, but they were the best cops in the world. Again, they were wrong more times than they were right.
And the racist.
There's a lot of racism happening going on there. They're not, quote, good guys. Again, in Cruising, the ending is very ambiguous about, you know, I don't want to give any spoilers, but there's the love ambiguity at the end of there. And Sorcerer, again, is the remaining character. Are the remaining characters okay? Like, yeah, they made out alive, but like, can they move past the experience that they went through? On and on and on. There's a lot of ambiguity, and I think Friedkin likes to play in that gray area. And I don't think it's necessarily, he always says like, well, I don't know, the audience will figure it out. And he references like 2001, often Kubrick's movie, which again is a very ambiguous movie on many levels.
But it's so mannered. It's so different from his kind of style. Doing 100 takes.
Right, exactly. But they're very much in dialogue with each other in a way. Mm-hmm. But so, David, I'm going to out you for a second that you're not a big horror guy. But I'm assuming to make this documentary, you had to watch The Exorcist a lot to try to get those clips.
I'm a medium horror guy. Mm-hmm. I'm not a horror guy to the level that you guys are, podcasts and stuff. I'm like, right, blue chip horror masterpieces and like sci-fi horror stuff, like Cronenberg, and I'm into, and Argento and Carpenter and stuff. But I, you know, how many horror movies do I see every year? You know, not that, maybe 10, maybe 20 sometimes, you know, not a ton.
Well, yeah, but
it's not like the my genre.
No, yeah. So I'm saying, from your perspective as someone who's had to dissect the movie, what's your take on it from a not horror nerd perspective that we are?
Yeah, sure. Because it's scratching different itches for me. So for me, I mean, French Connection is my top Friedkin, and was a huge movie for me when I saw it as a kid, learning about, you know, classic cinema, and it turned me on to, wow, you know, 70s cop movies can be like this. And I loved it. And I came to The Exorcist a little later. And the parts that I really love about The Exorcist are how long it takes in grounding you in the world and getting you to believe in the circumstances. And so the first, well, I guess it's a long time before we get to, you know, the actual exorcism in the room.
It takes well over
the first three quarters of the movie, living in that house and the relationship and the town and just building that world, I love, and I think is fantastic. I love when Father Marin comes and, you know, the exorcist stuff happens too, and it turns into, you know, a different kind of movie to me. And also that comes with so much more weight on it, watching in sort of present day, because what we know about The Exorcist is what happens in that room and the exorcism, and, you know, there's SNL skits about it, and, you know, it's referenced in cartoons and stuff, and you kind of know what might happen. Whereas, you know, when we're going through the questions of, you know, what's happening with this little girl and, you know, her medical drama. I'm really into it.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's what I missed is movies taking their time that way to build and not just trying to scare you and kind of be eager to impress you in a different kind of way. Like, I love how confident the movie is.
Right. Because, I mean, there are jump scares in this movie, but because it takes so much time to set up, like that telephone jump scare gets me every time. It's perfect. Right. But
which in reality was freaking shooting a gun.
Yeah, shooting a gun to get that reaction. It's insane. Like I said, while I was watching a lot of freaking movies this week, I realized there's a lot of scenes of people just walking. People walking through streets. And again, I think that's maybe something that he's trying to get us all to kind of relate to, because, you know, we all got to walk somewhere, whether you're walking your dog or going to catch a train or a cab or an Uber or whatever. There's all these scenes, but there's always something kind of popping in the background. That's kind of maybe unconsciously setting you up for something.
There's also like a metronome quality to it. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the idea that you have this beat. This is the person walking down the street. Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. Here comes the score. Score's popping up. Here's this. This is the rhythm of, okay, the car comes around the corner here. Pan out. Strings build up or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, I love that shit. And people don't do it enough anymore. Like you're saying, like, that idea of we're going to go for a walk through Georgetown, I believe is where it was. and like, you're just going to have that rhythm to it. And it matches the Tubular Bells score and points. And it just, you're like, it hypnotizes you the same way when a band is like jamming to like 4/4 over and over again. After a while, you're just like, all right, I feel a little, feel like I'm in with the musicians right now. And then, wah! Pazuzu, you know. It's like that, I feel like because he does that stuff, it lulls you. Mm-hmm. That's quick, quiet, loud, those contrasts are always so dramatic, but there's so much quiet, to the ratio is so different now.
Yeah, it's very layering on layering, like visually layering, soundscape layering, music layering, just rhythm. And then that's what I think the best directors can really do, is build up a rhythm, a visual rhythm.
Not only that, but atmosphere too.
Atmosphere. Exactly. So, yeah. Matthew, you since you're here now, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us your thoughts on William?
My name is Matthew, Matthias Thiel, or Matthew, my buddy Paul. Him and I, we have a podcast, just getting drunk and talking about B-rated horror films and stuff, and just having a good time doing it. The podcast is called Mutant City Horror.
Tell us about your thoughts on William Friedkin.
You're going to hate me for this, but I didn't really know too much about the guy. However, I will say that seeing his movie list, there's a lot of movies he's done that I've not watched. However, the ones that do stick out was The Guardian. I remember going to see that in theaters. I thought that was a really good movie at the time too. I was probably like 15, 16. I had a good time watching it. Other than that, The Exorcist is absolutely probably the most groundbreaking horror film of all time, I'd say. I like movies that kind of crawl under your skin and kind of hit you where, in a way where like it's always going to be stuck to you. And that's definitely one of those movies that has. And I can remember almost every scene. I can, you know, put that movie on hold for like 10, 13 years or so, and I can still remember everything about it. That's how much it's sunken in, kind of like any kind of like old Kubrick film has for me or something, you know? I absolutely, you know what, when I watched The Exorcist 2, by the way, not 2, but the original, I always tend to do it by myself in the dark and stuff like that, just to embrace the atmosphere. Because I, even as an older man now, it still fucking scares me. So, I don't know too much about the guy, but from what I'd seen here and It's just he seems to be a well-celebrated guy. I look on my YouTube list and see people that have appreciated him. They're all icons of horror and stuff. And so, yeah, he did a very good job at what he does. And I appreciate him very much. I'm glad to be here to partake in this event.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I want to move on to some of his more lesser-known movies that we might have seen. Obviously, I want to talk just for a minute about On the Dead Man's Chest. Is a fantastic Tales from the Crypt episode with Tia Carrera, what's his name, Sherry Rose, and I don't remember, Yul something. I'm sure I'll remember, but that's a great episode. And then with some really cool effects. But then also there's a movie he did called Bug, which is a really underrated, underseen movie. Really crazy ending. I love that movie.
I actually have watched that one. I totally forgot to put that one on the list once I seen. That was a good one.
What other underrated freaking movies? Oh, go ahead, David.
I just want to say the performances in Bug are outstanding. I mean, Michael Shannon and Ashley Judd. Michael Shannon, that was like, you know, one of his real breakout roles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he made that movie, he's like 75 or something.
Yeah.
You know, it's insane because that movie has such an edge to it. Or, you know, if a 25-year-old made it,
you'd be wow. Especially for a movie that takes place really in one room of two people just going batshit crazy.
Uh-huh. And the movie feels like it's going insane. It feels dangerous. Mm-hmm. Anyway. That was the beginning of him working with Tracy Letts, who's a great playwright, really cool character actor.
Yeah, didn't they do Bug as a play, an actual play? I think it was staged.
Mm.
Yeah, I think it started as a play, and then Killer Joe, they collaborated, same thing, I think.
I still haven't seen Bug or Killer Joe, and I'm ashamed to say the reason I've never seen Bug is because it came out the year we started our podcast, and one of our contributors gave it a bad review. But it's somebody I never agree with on anything anyway, so I don't know why it kept me from watching it. But I'm like, now I'm hearing you talk about it, I'm like, I have to give it another chance.
Yeah, okay, you should do it. Invite me on and I'll show you how good it is.
I would love to do that. You should do a second chances for Bugs.
Yeah,
I'll admit I was actually a bit surprised that he was the one that made that movie, because I do remember that movie standing out too when I saw the list. I was like, oh shit, no shit. Right.
So fresh and original for a guy that, you know, that was the beginning of his comeback, kind of.
Mm-hmm. Levi, go ahead.
I remember The Hunted,
mm-hmm.
With Benicio del Toro and Tommy Lee Jones. And they shared on the Bloody Good Horror Slack this week one of Friedkin's interviews, where he talks about Al Pacino. And I just want to make sure I get this quote right. He said, "I don't give a flying fuck into a rolling donut what Al Pacino thinks." And he then went on to praise Tommy Lee Jones and how prepared Tommy Lee Jones was for every role he ever did. And I guess he directed him in The Hunted with Benicio del Toro. So.
Yeah,
that quote's amazing.
Yeah, it's really good.
Always has
an
opinion.
Exactly. Find it on YouTube, because the way he says that is always good. And The Hunted was filmed, I believe, in Oregon, which was kind of a big deal when I was living in that area. So again, that's another really good one.
12 Angry Men with George C. Scott. My God.
Yeah, he directed the TV version. Yeah, that was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just love George C. Scott.
So do I. Good actor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do we have any closing thoughts before we wrap up?
Jade is criminally underrated.
The floor is open. David, another part that going back to Leap of Faith for a second. I was really touched by the ending of that movie. And I assume it's one of those editing things where it's just some random story he told that you just thought to put at the end. Where he talks about the Zen garden.
My memory is that the interview really built to that
Oh, really?
You know, pretty organically. I think it was part of the way, you know, Alexander kind of structured the questions and kind of, you know, Friedkin opened up more and more, you know, as the interview process went on, you know, a trust gets built and stuff, and sort of like peeling back the layers of an onion.
And yeah. Then, so,
you know, I remember Alexander saying, you know, I heard that. And in the moment I was like, we need to book tickets and go to Kyoto and shoot there. And I don't know, they got it in the rain. It's got like a light rain going on to it.
Yeah. So that was really
extra texture does something.
So that was the same rock garden that he sat in that was in the
middle. That's right. Yeah.
Wow. I thought you just went to like a local
rock garden. No, they went to Kyoto.
That's awesome.
Director Alexander and his DP went there. They went there like right as it was closing and got some nice slider shots, you know, shots around Kyoto. But you know, if I know you're in Pasadena, the Huntington Gardens rock garden looks almost exactly the same. We could have tried to cheat it
because it looks so much like the Huntington. I was like, is it the Huntington for a moment? So,
and it's the real deal.
Just to recap that for anyone that might not have seen it, but first of all, go see Leap of Faith because it's fucking awesome. So they kind of build up to this bit where he's talking about he went to Kyoto in Japan for the premiere of The Exorcist, and someone told him you gotta go see the Zen rock garden. He's like, I don't know what that is, but I'll go check it out. And he got there and he's like, what? It's just a bunch of rocks. That's like the most William freaking thing he could say. Is he sees a Japanese rock garden and says, so what? It's a bunch of fucking rocks. But he sits down and sits with it and just has like all these epiphanies. And the exact same thing has happened to me because I love rock. I really got to rock gardens just because, like, you sit there and just the stillness of it just is like almost is really kind of meditative in a way, and it just kind of opens you up. And he said within like 15 minutes or whatever, he just started like having all these emotions coming out and start crying sitting in this Japanese rock garden. And that's just like, that just really goes to the heart of like, he's just kind of a really strong, hard guy with a really big heart in the end. And you just, yeah, there's so many layers to get to it.
I think that's exactly it. And the rub between those two of the sort of ruthless Hurricane Billy kind of character, I kind of came to understand that serves to protect a real sensitive artist. And, you know, he has the rigor to sit there and go through these stages of emotions and open himself up to having that experience. But I think it's the rub between these two sides of Billy that is sort of the secret sauce that gives his movies his authorial signature, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Any other closing thoughts before we wrap up?
I watched Leap of Faith for the first time to prepare for this. And, a couple of things I took away from it from Friedkin is, like, he talks about his interest in fate and faith and how they kind of coalesce to make this film what it is. And it's also a film about faith. And then he talks about, like, as a director, spontaneity over perfection, which is where he got the gun idea. And he went on to punch an actor to make him cry, like... It's just, yeah, it's
with their permission, more or less.
Yeah, right. Can't do that today. And
it was the 70s. Or just catch him off guard.
Right. And he goes on to say you can't get away with that today, you know. And so, mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a wonderful documentary. And I want to commend David for what he did on it. So,
thank you so much. Thank you.
Yeah, second, I got to see that. I still have to watch that.
Freddie, any final thoughts?
On Shudder.
Yeah, it's on Shudder.
Yeah. I'm cool, sure I got Shudder.
Yeah. If you don't have Shudder, get Shudder, because again, that's... Freddie, anything else you want to say?
Well, no, nothing that's... I was just kind of touched by you reminding me about the rock garden and this idea of like that creative person. You're always kind of anxious, I think, like, because you always feel like I have to be making something or refining something I already made. And like, I think that part of that for me too is seeing him do something like that, especially someone who's older, who's been creative all of his life, that letting himself have a moment of peace might have been part of that too. Is just, I wanted to say, like, I think that's overwhelming for somebody who sees their value in things they create. They feel like they can't take a break from it. And I think that's intense. And that's kind of like a beautiful thing that he always seemed to be kind of finding his medium. And I find that kind of encouraging and kind of sad, but also very encouraging and double-edged and kind of beautiful.
Yeah. I think, yeah, that's a wonderful point. And, you know, it just goes to show he's such a layered guy. And, you know, we got to get to this kind of special, unique gear of Billy, because usually in an interview setting, we get the really fiery, fun, entertaining version of him. But, you know, we were able to show all these different colors of him in the movie and end with, you know, kind of the most special one.
Yeah. All right. Well, that wraps up another episode. David, Freddie, Levi, and Matthew, thank you for coming on. Where can people find you guys? Let's go in alphabetical order. So I believe that's Freddie.
Oh, okay. NOTLP.com, or you can search wherever you get podcasts, Night of the Living Podcast. And then I myself, I have a website, FreddieMorrisComposer.com, where I have links to all my music and art projects and things there on YouTube, TikTok, all that stuff too.
All right, David.
My handle across social media is David Zella, David SLA. So on Instagram or Twitter. And I made another documentary with the guy, Alexander Philippe, who directed Leap of Faith, that just came out in theaters, called Lynch/Oz, about David Lynch and his relationship to his favorite movie, The Wizard of Oz, sort of dissecting David Lynch's movies through that prism. And it'll be streaming soon. And so look out for that.
All right. Thank you. And then Levi.
Yeah, that sounds awesome, David, by the way. You can find me on Instagram at Levi Horn. That's Horn with an E. I paint monsters sometimes. I also just wrote and directed a short film that was nominated at the Texas Short Film Festival for Best Horror Short. And that's on Instagram at Madness Within. And then our podcast is at @well_adjusted_podcast on Instagram and on Threads. And then on Twitter, we're @well_horror on Twitter.
Okay, Matthew.
At Mutant City Horror on Instagram. I believe we're on Thread now. I've been working with Twitter, but I haven't really launched that yet. I don't think people are using Twitter too much anymore. So I don't know.
Twitter.
Yeah, exactly.
Max.
I believe, from what I understand, is you can find our podcast on, we started on Spotify. Somehow it made its way to Apple and other platforms. So I guess wherever you can find podcasts, you can find Mutant City Horror.
Okay. Well, next week, Das in the Crypt will be covering the 7th season episode of Tales from the Crypt, Horror in the Nights. We appreciate everyone for listening. We would really appreciate if you would give us a rating or review on iTunes, a rating on Spotify, and check out our YouTube for videos of these podcasts. With that, we thank you for listening to Dads from the Crypt.
Follow Dads from the Crypt on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or I will follow you to the grave. No, seriously, you really should watch. But be careful what you ask for. You may get it.